Shalom Aleichem, sweetest friends. We are going to be discussing the Siyata Dishmaya, the concept of Psak, of Paskening Halacha, how to Paskening Halacha, the mechanics of Paskening Halacha, the methodology of Paskening Halacha. And this is based on just a phenomenal article by one of the Gedolim Asher Ba'aretz, our Leich Shlita. And it should be a schus Refuas Chaya Chavit Fega Bas Michal Dispasia, and Leschus Refuas Dina Bracha Bas Esther Hadassa. Zos HaTorah Lo Sehim Uchlefes, Halacha is immutable, as the Rambam writes in the ninth of the Shnei Masari Ikrim, Shlosha Asari Ikrim. Therefore, halacha doesn't change. Facts change, situations change. When applied to different facts and variegated situations, halacha determinations need not be uniform. But they're not inconsistent. Halacha exists in two diverse realms, in the abstract and in the concrete. There is certainly room for disagreement and controversy in the realm of theoretical halacha, elel avdir elokim chayim. It's impossible to apply conflicting theoretical principles to matters of normative practice. Perforce, halacha must incorporate canons of decision-making. Those canons are themselves not without some degree of controversy. So different decisors applying different canons may on occasion issue diverse rulings. It's almost a truism that psak halacha is both a science and an art. To the extent that it's a science, its methodology can possibly be taught. To the extent it's an art, probably can't be taught. Either a person splats with artistic talent or not. A person either has a feeling for music or does not. People who have a talent can develop and apply that talent. But the process isn't so simple. We're nothing more than application of a set of principles to concrete situations involved. The task might be assigned to a properly programmed computer, or if Google could be the POSIC. So computer software is an invaluable tool, but halachic decision-making, of course, requires far more than that. So you can separate psak halach into three categories. We'll call the first substantive psak, a determination of bedrock halacha, i.e. a definitive establishment of rules and principles. And then there's adjudicative psak. So that means choosing between conflicting assertions regarding the correct formulation of a halachic rule or regulation. Most piske halacha involve adjudicating in one form or another between conflicting opinions or precedents. And then there's prophylactic psak, and that's a decision or directive designed to avoid arriving at a definite psak, a definitive psak. An alternative term might be halachic punting. Avoiding the need for a psak is an art in and of itself. So now we're going to examine each of these categories individually. First, substantive psak. Substantive or elemental psak halacha in its pristine form is deductive in nature. The halachic ruling is deduced from given sources. Substantive psak involves the process of la suke shmaitza liba de hilchasa, i.e. the use of a dialectic processes based upon authoritative sources in order to reach a normative conclusion. When a question is posed that is related to a computer, which we call the human brain, that has already been loaded with all the requisite legal and methodological information, the brain searches its data files and applies innate powers of deduction in order to find the answer to the specific question. Obviously, this genre of psak halacha is appropriate only for a Talmud Shehagia Lahora, a student who has acquired the degree of proficiency necessary to issue rulings. He has to know pshas, poiskim. Questions addressed in this manner result in answers that are compelled, just as the conclusion of an Aristotelian syllogism is compelled. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. The human intellect has no discretion with regard to arriving at that conclusion. Once the premises are accepted, that all men are mortal and that Socrates is indeed a man, There is no logical choice but to affirm that Socrates is mortal. When the human intellect is brought to bear upon a given set of premises, which in our case is the entire corpus of halakhic material, the conclusion should be readily apparent. However, the human intellect is idiosyncratic. Unlike the case with regard to Aristotelian syllogisms, in halakhic decision-making, different people may arrive at different conclusions. Shem she partzufem domin ze leze. Shem shem partzufem domin ze leze. Kachen deosem domin ze leze. Datan domin ze leze. Just like their faces are different, so to other intellects. So in the Talmud Yerushalmi and Brachas, Ches Aleph, it's not a case of one size fits all. Beyond elemental argument forms grasped by the intellect in a uniform manner, human thought processes diverge and are capable of arriving at different conclusions based upon the same set of premises. Different minds employ different thought processes and draw different conclusions from identical premises. To each of those minds, the decision reached is perceived as compelled. The conclusion arrived at by each individual are dictated by the manner in which his or her intellect has been quote-unquote programmed. Two orthopedists may look at the same x-ray of the lower spine. One says arthritis, the other sciatica. One's right, one's wrong. Both are equally skilled and equally proficient practitioners. Their disparate diagnoses are the result of individualized thought processes that no one can explain in precise neurological terms. Different people view the same set of Rorschach blots and perceive them as different representations. Indeed, the same person may at different times perceive different figures in the same inkblots. It's precisely this process that gives rise to the principle of Elazar Elohim Chaim. Scholars examine a single question and arrive at contradictory conclusions. Each conclusion is correct. Each conclusion represents the word of the living God. Qualified scholars sincerely engaged in a quest for halachic elucidation are infallible. Judaism recognizes a doctrine of scholarly infallibility. Judaism regards not only a single person to be vested with infallibility, but recognizes an entire class of people to be infallible, i.e. all required, all qualified rabbinic scholars. They are infallible in the sense that by definition their determinations, when based upon valid scholarship, can't be wrong. This concept is difficult to grasp because ostensibly halacha establishes something that's Mutter or Aser. How can both be true? Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim is an expression of a doctrine that contradictory conclusions are at times exactly what the doctor ordered. That's what Hashem wants. It's part of the divine plan. Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, in his Perush on the Chumash, Beis Halevi, Parshas Lech Lecha, explains the meaning of the divine appellation Shakai, rendered by the Chachamim as a yushit similar to an acronym connoting Ani hu she'amarti la'olami dai, I said to the universe enough. The created universe, according to the Beis Halevi, is a work in progress. Hashem created the raw materials necessary to support human existence. He allowed for refinement and development of those materials, but left it to man to complete the process by means of agriculture and craftsmanship. Seeds germinate and wheat grows in the field. Hashem could readily have provided a climate in which heavy winds would dislodge seeds from their stalks, beat them against one another until they become a powder, then cause the pulverized flour to become inundated by rain that would churn the flour into dough and thereupon cause the sun to shine brightly so that its heat would bake the dough into bread. However, Hashem said, enough. I've done as much as I'm going to do. The rest I leave to man to complete. Man is a partner with Hashem in completing the process of creation. Same with Torah. Revelation is the beginning of the halachic process, not the end. Hashem gave the Torah to Am Yisrael at Sinai, and revelation thereupon became complete. Revelation is a once-in-an-eternity event. Torah and its emergence halacha are not subject to change, but halacha must be applied in an infinite variety of circumstances, including phenomena and eventualities that could not possibly have been fathomed by Jews standing at the foot of Har Sinai. The Torah contains broad principles and even detailed minutia, but aside with regard to many specific matters and humanly unfathomed eventualities. It was the divine intention that man accept the Torah in its entirety, including Torah Sheba'al Peh transmitted through Moshe, accompanied by canons of interpretation, and then to apply human intellect to fill lacuna and to resolve questions as they arise. Provided that the scholar conducts his inquiry within the parameters of that process, the conclusions to which he is led are ipso facto valid. But those conclusions are the words of the living God only if they are reached by a scholar who's proficient in Shas and Poskim and arrived at those conclusions with intellectual honesty. The primacy of this form of psak is expressed in a quizzical yet penetrating statement of the Maharal of Prague. He was vehemently opposed to reliance upon the Shulchan Aruch of Rav Yosef Karo for the purpose of deriving halakhic rulings. Maharal regarded an undertaking of such an endeavor as potentially antithetical to the halakhic process, the Archaim Ova 6.6, the Sivas Olam, the Sivas Torah 15. Centuries earlier, there were those who objected to the dissemination of the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam. In the case of Mishneh Torah, there are two types of objection. There were objectors of whom Rav Avram David of Pasquay, I don't know how to pronounce that even, something in French, Ravid is the premier example, who in frequent instances didn't agree with the particular rulings of the Rambam. But others expressed a more fundamental objection. There were many prominent figures who were afraid that the Rambam would be successful. It is a well-kept secret, but the Rambam's project was an abject failure. The Rambam failed at what he set out to accomplish, but he was also wildly successful in what he didn't set out to do. He did achieve a measure of success in that the Mishneh Torah, together with the Rif and the Rosh, became one of the three primary sources followed by later Poskim. But his real success was in providing grist for Shiurim to be delivered by Rosh Yeshiva and in making puzzling statements destined to become the subject matter of scholarly disquisitions. He was highly successful in formulating conclusory statements that became comprehensible only upon brilliant and penetrating analysis. He enabled Rav Chaim Brisker and other expositors to postulate and demonstrate the heretical aspects of halacha that would not have occurred to them before the writings of the Rambam. The Rambam set out to do something far different, and to the minds of many, far less creative. The Rambam's purpose was to compose a restatement of Jewish law. He sincerely believed that with the availability of the Mishneh Torah, there'd be no compelling need for a person's library to contain more than a copy of the Chumash and the Mishneh Torah. You don't need other rabbinic works. A posek would be equipped to issue a halachic ruling simply by perusing the Mishneh Torah. Nevertheless, with the exception of a tiny group of Maimonidean adherents in Yemen, no one has ever accepted the Mishneh Torah as a kind of Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, or a simple and concise restatement of Jewish law. The Rambam didn't succeed in achieving that goal. Later, when the Shulchan Aruch appeared, it was met with the same opposition. But Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, disagreed with Rav Yosef Karo with regards to innumerable matters, and many others did so as well. But those disagreements, numerous as they may have been, were, in a manner of speaking, no more than a form of nitpicking. Scholars beginning with the Ramah accepted the work while seeking to correct perceived errors and to fill lacunae. However, scholars such as the Maharal and the Maharshal, the Yamshel Shlomo, opposed the very nature of the enterprise. They didn't welcome a dissemination of a brief digest of halachic determinations. Had it been within their power, they would have suppressed the work in its entirety. Their objections seem remarkably similar to those of professors who object to students' use of cliff notes, even though their answers to the examination questions based on those notes may be entirely correct. The answers may be correct, but the student's education is seriously truncated. The purpose of education is not simply to learn facts or find answers to particular questions, but to master the corpus of knowledge that yields those answers and that may be harnessed in exploring other issues as well. But the manner in which the Maharal expressed himself sounds extremely strange to our ears. He made the bold statement that he preferred rabbinic authority to rule on the basis of his independent proofs of the Gemara, the writings of the Rishonim and other rabbinic sources, even though one must fear that the result may be an erroneous decision, rather than having consulted the Shulchan Aruch and rule correctly. So many Sivas Ayilim, Siva Torah at the end of the 15th parak. Maybe his reasoning is that the fundamental principle of Elo Velo Divrei Elokim Chaim applies precisely to the type of substantive psak halacha that has been described. When a person who has mastered the entire oral law puts aside any possible biases that he might have, applies his intellect, and finally reaches a conclusion, that conclusion is mandated by divine providence. The scholar's conclusion is precisely the determination that God desired him to reach, and exactly how the Almighty wanted him to rule, despite the contradictory and equally valid rulings of Yosef Cairo. If some other qualified scholar declares the opposite to be correct, so be it. That is how the halachic process is designed to operate, by application of human intellect and formulation of diverse views. The Maharal didn't want a scholar to feel intimidated by the Shulchan Aruch. Even more momentous is the fact that he didn't want the halachic process to be stunted by removing the impetus for a scholar to embark upon his own independent investigation. Never mind that it is no less a personage than the author of Shulchan Aruch who disagreed, and that Maharal brands the view contravening the rule of Shulchan Aruch as incorrect. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim. To be sure, the person who makes no attempt lasuke shmaitza libe de hilchasa, i.e. to base his ruling upon investigation of primary sources, whether because of an inability to do so or because of laziness or convenience, and instead consults a compendium or an array of compendia, and relying upon such secondary sources reaches an incorrect conclusion on the basis of imprecise reading, inapt application, or incorrect analogy, cannot claim that his ruling is an embodiment of divrei Elokim Chaim. However, if a proficient scholar assiduously reviews the relevant material contained in Shas and Poskim and arrives at what Maharal would regard as an incorrect conclusion, his quote-unquote erroneous opinion is nevertheless within the parameters of Elu Ve'elu. Yet if he arrives at the wrong answer simply by perusal of Shulchan Aruch, he is responsible for his error. Maharal would prefer that the scholar reach a non-normative conclusion, provided that he does so legitimately in accordance with the principles of halachic dialectic, rather than have him find the normative rule by expeditiously consulting a compendium. There is no greater spiritual intellectual achievement in opening a book and finding the correct answer. There is no great spiritual intellectual achievement in opening a book and finding the correct answer. That is not the task assigned to a halachic decisor. The posek is supposed to proceed de novo in arriving at a decision. Unfortunately, what Maharal feared might occur is essentially what has become the prevalent and accepted norm. Maharal was perspicacious enough to recognize that it would occur, and he was saddened by the prospect. History, which is a synonym for divine providence, dictated that Shulchan Aruch would be accepted by the Jewish community, with the result that it became part of the chain of tradition. The intellectual capacity of recent generations has become diminished. It is not impetuous to assume that divine providence guided acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch, because we suffer from a dearth of rabbinic decisors sufficiently qualified and capable of independently recreating the decisions of the Shulchan Aruch, or parallel, but not identical, decisions in the process of Lasuke Shemaitza Lida de Hilchasa. Necessity, stamped with the divine imprimatur, requires acceptance of less than the ideal. There is a second substantive form of psak that may be categorized as issue-spotting psak, i.e. psak in terms of identification or categorization. In medicine, there is a process of differential diagnosis. A patient presents a wide array of symptoms. The physician may take cognizance of each one of the many symptoms and relate each of them to a particular malady, and in the process determine which and how many of these symptoms are related to one disease and which and how many to another. Of course, the physician must also recognize that some symptoms under the circumstances may be totally meaningless. On the basis of recognition of the import of the various symptoms, the physician determines the most likely nature of the illness and treats the patient accordingly. In the study of law, that endeavor is called issue spotting. When presented with a complex legal problem, a jurist or a student of the law must identify the issues. Only after the issues have been identified properly can one apply the law. In national law schools, professors pride themselves in asserting they don't teach the law. Rather, they teach the student to think like a lawyer. A typical law school examination consists of hypothetical fact patterns. The student is required to analyze the hypothetical and to identify the component issues. He or she must then bring to bear any statutory or case law that may apply. The latter exercise is generally the least of a competent student's challenges. The primary task is to identify the issues that are germane and require elucidation. There were great Rosh Yeshivas who gave smicha to boys who had not mastered Yoredei, but they were lamdanim, and they knew how to think like a posek. And when they have a shaila, so they'll if they don't know the answer, they're enough yorei shemayim not to answer. And once they master the sources, then they'll give the proper ruling. So they gave them smicha in the meantime until they master the sources, so they'll have the smicha. But at the time they didn't. But at least they could think like lamdanim, and they gave them smicha on that basis. The Maharsha records a remarkable comment in his Chiddush HaGadus, in Sota Daf Chav Beis Amud Aleph. The Maharsha bemoans the fact that scholars were relying upon the Shulchan Aruch rather than on their own halachic prowess. He bemoans that practice because, as a result, Poskim became intellectually lazy. In seeking answers, they no longer bothered to analyze the relevant Talmudic discussions. They simply relied on the Shulchan Aruch. In effect, they didn't find it necessary to think. They have the Shulchan Aruch. Then they drew false analogies and missed crucial distinctions. An excellent example of the type of issue spotting involved in the process of arriving at a Psak Halacha can be found in a sefer called Shimush Shel Hora. It's a multi-volume sefer on paskening shilas in Halacha. So this is in Siman Yud Gimel. The situation involved a person who was cooking a quantity of chicken legs in a large pot. Let's assume there were 55 chicken legs in the pot. Along came someone carrying a non-kosher chicken leg who proceeded to throw it in the pot. The intuitive response would be that the ratio of kosher legs to non-kosher legs is 55-1. It doesn't have it's not batel b'shishin. Hence, the non-kosher chicken leg doesn't become batel, and the entire pot isn't kosher. The Shimush Shel Hora points out that such a conclusion wouldn't be correct. Chicken legs contain bones. Bones are not meats, but are boileia. They're absorbent. Consequently, in the mixture of food that includes both kosher and non-kosher bones, and establishing the ratio for purposes of nullification, the non-kosher bones, which don't emit taste, may be ignored, while the kosher bones, which do absorb taste, are included in the establishment of the ratio of dominant kosher food in the mixture. The weight or mass of 55 chicken legs, from which the bones have not been removed, is far more than 60 times that of the meat of a single chicken leg minus its bone. If the chicken legs are all approximately the same size, the ratio of 55 legs, including bones, to the meat of a single leg minus its bone, is certainly more than 60-1, with the result that, ceteris paribus, the non-kosher chicken is nullified, and all the contents of the pot are kosher. Another example that is well known in yeshiva circles, this story, which may be apocryphal, involves Rav Chaim Britzker and an unnamed Polish rabbi who met at a chasana. Rav Chaim commented that one can't engage in psak halach unless he's a lamdan. The Polish rav countered that Polish rabbanim have no need for Britzker methodology. Rav Chaim is reported to have responded by posing a seemingly elementary question. Suppose that two women, one Jewish and the other non-Jewish, were both cooking outdoors in separate pots. Some of the contents of the non-kosher pot accidentally spilled into the kosher pot. Whether or not there were 60 times more the food in the kosher pot than in the non-kosher pot is a matter of empirical doubt. Does the food remain kosher? So you have a suffix, some non-kosher food from a non-kosher pot fell into a kosher pot, and we don't know if there's shishim. Is the food kosher? So the Polish Rav answered that since it's the same type of food, it's min b'minay, and therefore they have the same tam, All you need is a rov. Min b'mina, all you need is a rov. Shishim is the rabbanim. Since it's certain that the mixture contains a roiv of heter, midaraisa t'mutter. The only question now is the rabbanim. It's the rabbanim, you need shishim. So you have a suffix, the rabbanim. Suffix, the rabbanim, l'kula. Simple enough. To that answer, Reb Chaim responded, I said that this was a non-Jewish woman who was cooking. Non-Jews don't soak and salt their meat before cooking. So there must have been some residual blood in the meat. The blood in the meat is of a category quite distinct from that of the meat itself. So therefore, it's min b'she'enu mino. The non-kosher item of one class mixed with kosher items of a different class. Since they're different classes and of dissimilar taste, so you need midai raisa shishim. Therefore, it's a suffix d'oraisa and tzlachuma. All right, said the Polish Rav. I'm mistaken. But, countered Reb Chaim, in conceding errors, once again, you missed the point. Don't you realize that for the majority of poskim, blood that has been cooked is no longer d'oraisa? Cooked blood is d'rabban. So now we're back to suffix d'rabban makula. Oh, Polish Rav said, you're right. Another one. I'm mistaken again. Oh, but wait. Says Reb Chaim. You again fail to recognize that because the meat wasn't kosher, the blood in the meat is prohibited not only because it is blood, but because of another prohibition as well. Cooking blood obviates only the midoraisa of consuming blood, but it's still an avela since the animal wasn't properly slaughtered. The animal has the status of an avela, and the blood is also subject to the isur nevela, uncooked. And cooked nevela are equally forbidden. Consequently, the cooked blood remains biblically prohibited, not as blood, but as a nevela. So again, we're held in the hour that we have a daraisa problem. By that time, the Polish rabbi was exceedingly embarrassed. Rav Chaim then delivered the coup de grace. You overlooked an explicit statement of Taisus and Psachim. Taisus Psachim 22a declare that dam is not b'chlal behema. It's not included in biblical references to an animal. And hence blood is not subject to the iser of consuming an avela. Accordingly, we are back to a doubt only with regard to the nullification of cooked blood, a rabbinically prescribed substance to which the principle, suffik derabanan lakula, applies. There's another version in which one further step is added. See the sefer of Rav Shimon Yosef Miller, Uvdois van Hagos Lebeitz Brisk, pages 217 to 218. The source of that is apparently a report of Rav Menachem Mendel Chaim in the Moriah Journal in 5732 Sivan Tammuz, page 9. In that version, Rav Chaim pointed out that the animal that the non-Jewish woman was cooking was a treifa. I had suffered a trauma that rendered it non-kosher rather than a vela. So the blood is a trefa, not an avela. The blood in the avela is not prohibited because it's regarded as distinct from and not integral to the flesh of the animal. The blood of the trefa, even though it's indeed distinct from the animal, is yetzim and a trefa. It emerges from a trefa while the animal is still alive, and therefore it's biblically prohibited. The blood of a trefa is, halachically speaking, quite unlike the blood of an avela. And that blood is produced during the lifetime of an animal. If the animal is a treifa, its blood is a product of a treifa. Because the animal cannot be an avela while it is still alive, and subsequent to its death, an animal can no longer produce blood. And so the blood of an avela is not yetzim in an avela. A person who consumes the yetzim of a treifa may not incur the punishment of lashes, but it's asur d'oraisa. So this is an issue, this is what we call the issue spotting. There is yet another form of substantive psak halacha, analysis of the intrinsic nature of the matters involved. This type of analytic psak is different from the identification of relevant halachic principles. Analytic psak involves examination of the very essence and nature of an applicable halachic provision. It is commonly known that if a person didn't say Shmoneh Esrei, he has to say two Shmoneh Esreis next time. So let's say he forgets Atachon and Tanu in. Let's say he doesn't daven Ma'ariv Motzei Shabbos. He doesn't daven Ma'ariv Motzei Shabbos. He has to daven twice Sunday morning. So the first tefillah is for is Shachris, and the second tefillah is for Ma'ariv. When do you say Atachon and Tanu? So in Pashtus, he says Atachon and Tanu. The second tefillah, because it's a makeup for Ma'ariv, and that's when you say Atachon and Tanu. And Ma'ariv, whoever, Bikiv Eger or Chaim Soloveitchik, rule differently. If Rav Chaim says, what's Pshat Atachon and Tanu? Is it a din in Ma'ariv, or is it a din in the first Shmoneh Esrei after Shabbos? If it's a din in Ma'ariv, then you say it the second time. But it's din in the first Shmoneh Esrei after Shabbos, which is usually Ma'ariv, then you would say it in the first. You'd say it at Shachris. That's the way Paskins. That's how the Shiran is. Also, Tam Ki Iker, that the paste is like substance. So if you have a certain substance that's Asir, even the taste is Asir. And the Gemara deduces a biblical source for this. So is Tam Ki Iker simply a novel prohibition superimposed upon the prohibition, attendant upon the prescribed substance? Or is the prohibition more subtle in nature? Taste exists without substance only when a prohibited substance is dipped into a quantity of a permitted substance and removed, leaving behind only taste but no recognizable substance, or when the prescribed substance loses its identity because it has become nullified in a larger quantity of permitted substance, but the taste of the forbidden substance remains recognizable to the palate. Since in both cases some residual substance remains, it is not clear that Tam Ki Iker is a novel prohibition. The more subtle theory can be expressed as an assertion that the usual principle of bittul is not operative if the taste of the forbidden substance remains. Expressed in other words, is Tam Ki Iker a novel halachic principle? Is it a chiddush? Or is Tam Ki Iker represent merely a mitigation of or an exception to the rule of nullification of forbidden substances? What's the difference? Logical positivists assert that the meaning of a proposition is its mode of verification. I have added a codicil. Halachic positivism is the notion that the meaning of a halachic proposition lies in its mode of halachic verification. The import of a hakir and a halacha, i.e. possible theoretical alternative analysis of a halachic principle, is to be found in the nafkamina that is manifest in applied halacha. Verification of the theoretical nature of Tam Ki Iker is to be found in its application or non-application with regard to its role in the Noahide code regarding a limb torn from a living animal. The issue is addressed by Rav Moshe Sofer and Jews Chasim Sofer Yeredeya Simon Yates. Suppose that a non-Jew has a small piece of Aver Minachai, a limb torn from a living animal, that falls into a pot of food. He then removes the Aver Minachai, but the taste of that piece of meat has permeated the entire mixture. Is the meat in the pot permitted to the Noahide? The intuitive response would be that there's no rule of Tam Ki Iker with regard to Noahide commandments. Thus, the pot of meat would be kosher for a Noahide. But, says the Chasim Sofer, neither is there a principle of bittul, berov, in the Noahide code. Consequently, since taste originates in the substance, and there cannot be taste without substance, even though the quantity of the substance represented by the taste is minute, the substance that had given rise to taste is not subject to nullification. The result is that taste is forbidden, not because it's taste, but because the rule of bittul doesn't apply to the underlying forbidden substance. Applying a halachic version of Occam's razor, one must deduce that Tam Ki Iker is not a novel rule even for Jews. Cancellation of the principle of nullification would suffice in itself to render food containing the taste of forbidden food non-kosher. An example of greater halachic relevance. Chazaka ein adam osa bi'ilaso bi'ilas znus. Yevamos 107a, Ksuvos 73a, Gittin 81b. In other words, the halachic presumption that given a choice, a person intends his act of coitus to be for the purpose of contracting a marriage rather than an act of promiscuity. The principle certainly has the flavor of cheskas kashrus, a presumption that given the option, people act licitly rather than illicitly. But what if the person in question is a notorious evildoer who could not care less about such matters? Does such a person's lifestyle vitiate the chazaka of ein adam oisa b'ilaso b'ilas nus? The practical effect would occur in cases of civil marriage, followed by the couple establishing a common domicile and publicly identifying as man and wife. Is it to be assumed that consummation of the relationship is for the purpose of establishing a valid marriage? The matter was indeed the subject of dispute in earlier generations. Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin and Rav Moshe Feinstein in our time assumed opposing positions famously. Rav Moshe maintained that cheskas chazaka ein adam oisa b'ilaso b'ilas nus is simply a cheskas kashrus. And Rav Henkin said it's a cheskas hanhaga. It's a principle of human comportment based upon the psychological presumption that no man allows his wife to be promiscuous. The presumption, this is Igros Moshe ben Ezer, Chelek Aleph, Simon Hay, Ayin Dalit Ayin Zion, number Ebenezer 2, Simon Yates 3, Chav Hay 4, Pepe Aleph, and Rav Henkins in Perushe Ivra, part 1, chapters 3 and 4. So he says, the Rav Moshe says the Cheskas Kashrus, that people are assumed to be law abiding. And Rav Henkin, it's a Cheskas Hanhaga. No man wants his wife to be promiscuous. The presumption, argues Rav Henkin, is that a person entering into such an enduring conjugal relationship, even if it's not contracted in accordance with halachic formulae, wishes a monogamous relationship and will not countenance promiscuity on the part of his wife. That is simply human nature, asserts Rav Henkin, and such is the import of the principle Eidam Oisa Bilasa Bilasnus. Since a halachically valid marriage can be established by cohabitation alone, a public and notorious relationship as husband and wife, the equivalent of common law marriage in other legal systems, rises to the level of a halachic marriage. The dispute turns upon the correct substantive analysis of the nature of the chazak in question. Whether or not a get is required to dissolve the relationship is a matter of analytic psak. Many Talmudic dicta literally beg for such analytic scrutiny. Tav lemeitav tandum lemeitav amlu. Better to live as a couple than to live alone. Yevamos 118b, Bava Kama 111a. That Talmudic dictum is often cited as a declaration that every woman prefers marriage over spinsterhood. This statement is made by the Gemara in the context of a discussion of levirate marriage, in which the prospective husband is a brother-in-law who suffers from a malodorous dermatological condition that renders physical contact repugnant. He's a mukashchin. Thus, the ostensive import is that every woman would prefer even the most loathsome of marriage partners to a lifetime without a husband. As cited, the Gemara is purported to state a universal truism about the female psyche. But such an assertion is demonstrably untrue. There are women who make no attempt or have ceased to attempt to find husbands. There are countless women who reject prospective suitors, even though they fully realize that they have no realistic chances of finding a more desirable mate. So maybe the Chas V'Shalom, the Chachmei HaGemara, were laboring under some Chas V'Shalom type of delusion? Or maybe we live in a different world? Maybe there's a change in the mindset of women, in economic, sociological, or cultural factors? So then the halachic provisions predicated upon the announced empirical principle should no longer pertain. In particular, at least in some extreme circumstances, a woman should be released from levirate bonds because, had she been aware of the fate in store for her, ab initio, she would not have consented to the marriage. Arguably, this result should not be limited to a childless marriage in which there are levirate obligations, but should also be the case with regard to all marriages in which a husband becomes afflicted with a degenerative physical malady or develops insufferable character traits. However, such a conclusion is a result of a faulty understanding of the words of the Gemara. Conclusion rests upon the reading into the words of the Gemara much more than those words serve to establish. A correct understanding of the text reveals that the Gemara does not make a universal assertion about every woman. The Gemara does not state that every woman prefers a mukesh to smithereth. In the context, the Gemara is considering the case for retroactive nullification of a marriage, in which the woman faces yibum, levirate marriage, with a mukashchin. The contention is that she would not have entered the marriage in the first place had she known that her husband would die without children, and consequently she would find herself with a mukashchin as a spouse. Hence, the marriage which was contracted in Aaron should be regarded as void ab initio. To be sure, the marriage to have been expressly conditioned upon the non-occurrence of a future event, the occurrence of that event retroactively invalidate the marriage. However, in the absence of such a stipulated condition, the marriage can be considered conditional in nature, only if such condition can be imputed to the parties. But in order for an unexpressed condition to be implied, it must be a condition that would have been intended by everyone, and hence is self-evident to the point that verbalization of the stipulated condition would be unnecessary. Ordinarily, to be effective, conditions must be expressed. A mental reservation doesn't rise to the level of a condition unless the reservation is known, not only to the stipulating parties, but would be imputed to the parties by all persons. That which is in the hearts of all people, the leiv kol adam, is if it has been expressed verbally, anansade, all members of the public at large are witnesses to the existence of such a condition. If a matter is known to all and sundry, then express articulation is superfluous. That would indeed be the case with regard to an umdina, an understanding in his heart and the heart of every person. Such a condition would indeed be imputed in a world in which no woman would, under any circumstances, consent to marry a mukashchin. If, however, there is even a remote possibility that some woman would agree to marry such an individual, it cannot be said that such an implied condition exists. Marriages involving a mukashchin certainly do occur. Some women expect proposals of marriage for men suffering from inordinately severe disabilities. Some women even agree to marry men who have already repeatedly abused other women repeatedly. Some women even marry men who have abused them prior to the marriage. Some women, for whatever reason, choose to accept an onerous marital situation rather than a life of loneliness. Yashab Ber Soloveitchik, the Beis Halevi, the third volume, in Siman Gimel, explains that to ratify the ongoing validity of a marriage under newly arising onerous circumstances, all that is necessary to defeat the contention that there exists an implied condition that would serve to nullify the marriage is evidence that some women would wish to continue living in a marriage even under such conditions. Thus, the dictum that Tov Lemeitav Tandu Melemeitav Armelu is not a universal proposition. It doesn't reflect the notion that all women have such a preference. It reflects only the proposition that some women have such a preference. The Chachmei HaGemara did not err in their assessment of women, nor has feminine psychology changed. Recognition that even a small number of women manifest such a preference defeats the notion of an implied condition. Such an implied condition can be imputed only if a condition of that nature could be presumed to be the unexpressed stipulation of all women. But how does an aspiring halachic decisor hone analytic skills? As noted, Psak Halacha is an undertaking that involves elements that should be described as an art rather than a science. How does one teach an art? It's very difficult, if not impossible, to teach someone to be a musician. I am living proof of that. I wanted to learn how to play a musical instrument, but I was born with no musical talent and hence could not develop it because I just didn't have it. A person has to have some inclination, some aptitude, and then he can be trained. That's what it means. Gedola shimusha yosem alimuda. You become proficient through experience. In other words, you have to have certain kalim to start with, certain kishrono, certain talents to start with, and then you keep studying more and more. You mashamish tamid chachamim, and you learn how to paskin halacha. Okay, sweet friend, so this is the first part of our discussion. There's loads more to say, so please stay tuned. We know that we shall continue. Thank you so much for listening.